This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. There's a new group of candidates on the ballots of the town and city elections in Lake County this year. Candidates who want to become the next generation of public officials. Democratic Party Chairman Jim Weiser was on Regionally Speaking to talk about them and why they're interested in politics.
In Hammond, you may note that two new folks, Barry Tyler and Katrina Alexander, both won primaries over long-term incumbents and did it by grassroots, I mean, totally grassroots organizations. Both of them are very young people, both of them very engaged in their community. They're going to be, I think, great additions to the Hammond City Council. In Gary, for example, we have two more people, Ty Atkins, a young lady who ran. Now, that was an open seat because Carolyn Rogers didn't run for re-election in the 4th District. But there were, my recollection is, five or six candidates, and Ty came out successful. Young lady, 32 years old, Gary Westside graduate. I played college basketball. She's just a very smart, dynamic young lady. Then Bill Godwin, who won in the 1st District in Gary, another bright young face. Then over in Lake Station, Bill Carroll, who won for won the primary for mayor, again, another open seat, is a young man, young businessman, and was recruited because he was just interested in his community. He owns a business in the community. It's successful. He wants to keep it that way, and he wants to do what's well. Then kind of moving back over in Munster, we recruited a young lady who's running for clerk treasurer, and her name's Jennifer Pizzuto Dean. And she's a very bright young lady, a Munster resident virtually her whole life, and again, someone who wanted to get active and got very involved in having talked to her numerous times, very involved in national concerns about national politics. She wanted to translate it into local, have a local impact. In Highland, we just caucused in to replace Dan Vassar, who decided after a very successful term as a councilman that he wanted to spend more time with his family and pursue other interests. We caucused in a young man named Martin Del Rio, 32 years old, a veteran, works in Veterans Affairs, as a matter of fact. Bright young guy who I think is just going to fit in really well, and that's something that's near and dear to my heart since I spent two terms on the Highland Town Council in my former life. I'm really pleased about Martin being involved. We have out in Crown Point, and I'm jumping around a little, a young man, Zach Bryant, 28 years old, born and raised in the community, Andrean grads, got an MBA. And he's the general manager of Crown Brewing, which is the family-owned, his family-owned business. Here in Schererville, for example, we have two new faces and relatively young faces, too. Vanessa Welty running in the 5th Council District and Robin Arvanitis running in, I think that's the 3rd District. Believe me, Chris, it hasn't been that difficult recruiting these folks. When you get out there and you let them know that you want, we always start out with the premise that this is for your community. Mm-hmm. This isn't necessarily, although we like it to be for the Democratic Party, but this is a way to give back to your community and to do for your community. And we knew people that have volunteered, people that were involved in their community, so we went out and recruited them, and fortunately have been very, very successful.
Are they finding that in most cases that these are people that are very well aware of the fact that they're going to have to work hard to go out there and campaign? Maybe there may be luckily in communities where there are Democratic majorities, but they may be in some places where there are still a lot of Republicans that are still in office, and they're going to have to go out there and convince people that they're willing to take the job and they're worthy of taking the job.
Well, that's a great point, Chris. We don't give them any false illusions. We don't go out there and tell them, you know, that it's going to be a walk in the park. We let them know that it's challenging in any community. And particularly in those communities, for example, where Zach Bryan's running, where it's, I don't even think that Crown Point's ever had a majority Democratic council. I don't believe they have. So, and he's running at large. And he knows the challenges ahead. I spent not only myself, but others spent many hours talking to Zach about what it would take. And what I've always said, Chris, and I point this out to people that ask me often about Chris Chung. Well, you know, how does a 26-year-old young man who's never been involved in government or politics, how does that happen? And it's always my premise that the first and foremost thing is you've got to have a committed candidate. You've got to have a candidate that I say has the fire burning in the belly. That's what you have to determine. It can't be something where someone says, geez, you know, if you don't have anybody else, maybe I'll think about doing it or I might do it. No, that isn't what works. What works is somebody that says, I want to do this. I have a desire to do this. I have a plan to do this. This is what I think. That's what's needed. And that's and those are the kind of people, those are the kind of folks we've got running now. And that's why I feel so good about it, because they're in it for the right reasons. They're in it because they want to do it. They're in it because they want to serve their communities. They don't hold any illusions about that it's going to be a cakewalk or anything. They know, and they have been since the primary, all working very, very hard. We've set up a program, and I'm meeting with a number of the folks next Wednesday, Wednesday the 10th, kind of like an organizational meeting. And we've come up with an idea, kind of sort of put together by Chris Chung and myself, and along with the help of the my precinct organization and our officers, to put together sort of an internship program. And we've got a number of young people that are seniors in high school, freshmen in college, young folks that want to work and get involved in government and in politics.
That's Lake County Democratic Party Chairman Jim Weiser in our conversation back in July. Lake County Republican Party Chairman Dan Durnell also joined us recently to talk about the GOP candidates here in the county in the general election, the campaign up ahead.
Especially in the south part of the county where it's a little more, conservative. We have a lot of folks that are running. And in fact, we even filled a couple of spots throughout the county last month in our caucus. So we have difficulties, to be quite honest, to find people in the northern part of the county. Mm-hmm. But we do have people running, for example, in Highland. We have a full slate of candidates in Griffith, and in fact, every position in Griffith is predominantly in a primarily Democratic town. Each one is a Republican that holds the office from the clerk treasurer and town council. Mm-hmm. We have three people that are running in Highland, so we're looking at that. And of course, Munster, we have a full slate, and that's on the north. And we move to the south. Cherville, St. John, Dyersey, Lake, and so on. We have a full slate. But interesting to see, we have a couple of people running in East Chicago. We also caucused somebody in for Gary for a city council spot, and we have three people that are running in Lake Station, which is new. It's a new frontier, I guess, for us. For many years, we've had a person here and there, but these are pretty good candidates, and we're going to be able to offer something to the residents in these towns, so they have a choice. Now it's up to them. I think our model, our product, is better than the Democrats, but I would assume my friend Jim Weiser would say the same about his.
are you finding that in many of these cases that we have these Republican strongholds and traditionally Democrat, that some of these strongholds from in South Lake County are finding their way up north, or are these homegrown candidates, so to speak? These are people within the communities, like, as you mentioned, East Chicago and other places up in North Lake County, that have decided that they want to become viable candidates out there and put out an option for voters to choose in November.
Well, specifically on the north end, we'll talk Lake Station.
Okay.
It seems like everyone in Lake Station that is running that I met are people that have lived in that city forever. I mean, not their whole life, most of their lives. And they want to make a difference. You know, they don't like some of the way things are happening. For example, and again, Lake Station, you know, the selling of the water utility was something that they might not have agreed on. So they're, you know, they're going to put that out for, you know, for as an example. Now, again, people might say, no, we like that utility to be sold, you know, so we get us out of the financial woes that we have. Again, by the way, that was during a Democratic administration.
Yeah.
And those are things that I think, you know, we'll be able to offer to our people. Now, you know, I also realize, you know, again, you know, it's hard to find people in some of these positions because, I mean, historically, for many decades, they've been held by, you know, Democrats. But slowly but surely we're looking at, you know, trying to get in and again, offer that that product, if you will, and show that we are a viable alternative. And, you know, why not give us a chance? Because, quite frankly, you know, I mean, you look at some things that have happened in Gary, even Lake Station and so on. I think there's a different way to approach government and how to run a city or a town.
And some of these traditional Republican strongholds, I guess you can call them, I hate to really use the word, it's kind of overused, but in places where the Republican Party has done very well traditionally, would these places, we'll say like Munster and even Highland for that matter, are these locations that I would say that you don't want to be overconfident, but you feel comfortable in knowing that Republicans are likely to stay in office there?
So I tell you two tales. We'll talk about Munster a little bit. They have a full slate. Mm-hmm. These are folks that are running. There are a couple of new folks that are running. Some of them are incumbents, and they will put out a full, I guess, contingent of good news of where they are in Munster. On the other hand, if you look at St. John, which I believe we will keep every position in St. John. There was a pretty heated primary. And the bottom line for me is this. You know, I met the people that won, and unfortunately or fortunately, whatever way you want to look at it, I'm pretty indifferent. I just want good Republicans to win. They actually, the incumbents lost. And the people that won, I like every one of them, actually, and I'm looking forward to winning. They still will have to put out their product. I know they will win, and I know we'll keep every seat in St. John. So I'm excited for the people in St. John, the people. And just so you know, as it relates to, the primary, that's a party function. You know, Democrats have a primary as we do, and with that you have whoever the party, the majority of the people in that party win, and that's who goes on to the general election. So it's a party function in a sense, and the people in St. John's chose people that are non-incumbents. So they want new blood, they want new ideas, and all we're all for that. So I'm excited. Yeah. To see what happens.
So you pretty much expect these little political battles to take place during the primary election, and then hope that that by the time November comes and it's time to go to the general election ballot, that everybody is pretty much at least behind their own sides and can, as you say, kind of focus on the idea of this is the best candidate, this is what I can offer, and go from there, huh?
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, you know, for me as a chairman, I've taken the approach, look, you know, I mean, of course, I think the Republican brand is the best. You know, I mean, I wouldn't be the chairman if I didn't think that.
Well, yeah.
But we also have to sell ourselves and show why we're the best. Don't take anything for granted. the folks that are running in every town, they still will have to work, walk. You know, I'm on the county council also, and I walked last year when I ran, and I did okay. But you have to get out there. Don't take anything for granted, because if you do, you don't want to be saying on election night, uh-oh. You know, you want to make sure that you have your team winning and yourself, of course, winning if you're a candidate.
That's Lake County Republican Party Chairman Dan Durnell, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. With another edition of Building Northwest Indiana, here's Kevin Comerford with his guest, Roman Bronson.
Welcome to another episode of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. My name is Kevin Comerford. I'm the Director of Professional Development at the Construction Advancement Foundation of Northwest Indiana. I will be your host today. The purpose of Building Northwest Indiana Radio is to give you a little insight into the Northwest Indiana professional construction industry. Today, we will be talking about the Indiana Plan for Equal Employment, which is an organization that addresses the issue of low minority participation in the union building trades. My guest today is Roman Bronson. Roman is a union journeyman electrician. He is currently the Northwest Indiana coordinator of the Indiana Plan for Equal Employment. Roman, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure being here.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about your organization, the Indiana Plan for Equal Employment, and what is your role as area coordinator?
Okay, yeah. The Indiana Plan is a longstanding community outreach program. We've partnered with the building trades as well as contractor association groups to reach out to underrepresented populations within the building trades. So that's minorities, women, veterans, groups of that nature. I'm the Northwest Indiana Area Director. It's a statewide organization, and our main office is in Indianapolis.
Can you briefly talk about how you get people involved in your application process? You know, how does somebody go apply to get into your program and get involved in your community outreach program?
We have an online application. That's primarily the way that we collect applicants. You do have the option of coming in and applying paper, but it just works better as far as applying online. As far as what you need to apply, just a valid driver's license. You need a high school diploma equivalent, and also you got to know that we do drug testing. So we work with the Building Construction Resource Center that handles all of our drug testing, and those are the main requirements as far as getting involved with the program.
What is the web address where people can go to apply?
It's IndianaPlan.org, I-N-D-I-A-N-A, plan.org.
And I take it they could access the application from the front page of that website?
Yep. It's right there in the front descriptions. You'll see a highlighted text.
For an applicant that actually goes through the application process, they pass the admission test, they pass the drug screening. What is the next step for that applicant? I mean, what can they expect while going into the program?
Okay, yeah, that's a good question. So if you are selected for the Indiana Plan, we have limited spots available. We have quarterly classes, and we usually do around 10 people per class. But if you are involved with our program, what you can expect is further understanding of apprenticeships as far as how to apply, what to expect during an apprenticeship. We also have presentations from different union officials to give you an in-depth understanding of what that industry is all about and how to be successful in it. We also get you some safety credentials so you can start building your resume. And we also work with certain contractors to get you some on-the-job training so, again, you can start building your resume and become a better applicant for an apprenticeship.
Do you ever take the applicants and go visit a construction job site to give them firsthand knowledge of what goes on a job site, or do you take them to any of the various apprenticeship training centers here in Northwest Indiana?
Yeah, we do site tours of different apprenticeships. It's 21 different apprenticeships represented around Northwest Indiana, and we try to get a percentage of that as far as going to their facilities and getting presentations by their apprenticeship coordinators. We are also working on visiting different construction sites. Those are a little bit more spotty because there's some safety things that you got to take into account before you can go on a construction site. A lot of hazards there. But definitely all those things that helps inform an individual as far as what the industry is all about and how they can get involved.
So you're an electrician by trade. You were trained to local, was it 697?
Yeah, 697, yes, sir.
So you have kind of direct knowledge of what it takes to succeed in the industry as a union tradesman. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what it takes to get into a career in the construction trades and what kind of individuals tend to succeed?
It may sound a little corny, but some of the main attributes you got to have is you got to be enthusiastic about the your career choice. I would say working through an apprenticeship, as far as applying, is usually it takes time to get through that application process. So I would definitely say patience. That enthusiasm helps get you through that whole process and have a good attitude about it. Also, working hard. I mean, you got to have that work ethic. Something as well as you got to like to be outside. Primarily, you're going to be working outside, whether it's hot, cold, it's, you know, all these different weather conditions. You got to be able to enjoy that. You got to be willing to step up to challenges. I mean, getting through an apprenticeship, being on those job sites, it's tight deadlines, it's high quality expectations, and you got to be able to meet all that and not just meet it but exceed it. One of the more important attributes is being on time. Punctuality is one of the main criteria that they're looking for. You got to be there every day and on time. Also, remaining drug-free. You got to realize that certain things aren't worth your career. So those are some of the major points as far as what's going to make a good tradesperson.
That's a lot of great information about the Indiana plan, Roman. Unfortunately, we are out of time today, but we're going to pick up this conversation next week. Well, that'll do it for today's edition of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. Thanks again to our guest, Roman Bronson, with the Northwest Indiana Director of the Indiana Plan for Equal Employment. For more information on the Indiana Plan, please visit their website at www.indianaplan.org. And for more information about all the trades, you can visit www.webuildnwi.com.
Kevin Comerford, the host of Building Northwest Indiana, speaking with Roman Bronson. Support for Building Northwest Indiana comes from the Construction Advancement Foundation. You can hear Building Northwest Indiana on Tuesdays here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. And the podcasts are also available online at lakeshorepublicradio.org. Our next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project takes first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
So one of the hard things about being bisexual is that it's kind of hard to figure out for yourself growing up. I know a lot of gay friends of mine have said they knew very early on, you know. And I guess that makes sense. If I look back, if I recollect, I can see signs of it. But at the time, it was really hard to think about because, yeah, maybe I really thought some Disney princesses were absolutely beautiful, but the princes were really cute too. And it's easy to kind of ignore that weird section when you've got the normal section over here. Normal, obviously, is subjective. My mom really struggled with it. She had a really hard time. And not because she felt like it was inherently wrong, although she did have some issues with that, I remember. Like, she was like, well, why? I don't understand. Why can't you just pick one and just stay that one? Because it was hard for her to wrap her head around. And I was like, it's just not that way. Like, I can't just pick. It's not an active choice. And of course, I was like really frustrated because I didn't know how to articulate it to her. And then she said, well, why wouldn't you just choose to only be with men because it's so much easier? I can see why you would tell someone who's bisexual it would just be easier for you if you only dated men. Because obviously I have the capacity to do that. I do. If I decided, well, I like both, but I should really only date men because that's more socially acceptable. Technically speaking, I could do that. What's hard to explain is it just feels like lying to yourself in a way that I don't know is easy to explain. It's like you've got something inside you, like half of you, and you're just not telling people about it. And not only that, you're kind of like trying to pretend it's not there, but you know it's there. It's surprising that the gay community is so judgmental and harsh on the bisexual community. I hear it all the time. And I hear it more from the gay people than from the straight people. For whatever reason, straight people are more willing to accept that you could be attracted to both genders. But gay people will say, oh, it's just someone who's gay and they don't want to admit they're gay. So, like, they talk about it like it's an in-between stage, kind of in a condescending sort of way, where it's like, oh, you think that now, but you'll come over here eventually. To me, the word gay covers gay men and then lesbians, and it doesn't cover anything else. I think the word queer is like a blanket. It's a nice blanket. We can all crawl under it. If you said, oh, you know, it's Queer Week, I'd be like, hey, that's me.
And you can hear more stories online at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and back with us in the studio today is Northwest Indiana political activist Ruth Needleman. Ruth, thank you for coming back.
So good to be here again.
Well, a lot of things to talk about, a lot of things coming up here.
A ton of things.
I'll just turn things over to you and take us through what's happening and what's going to happen.
Let's start with this weekend.
Okay.
This is Labor Day weekend. For a lot of people out there, you say, oh, barbecues, oh, last day at the beach. But Labor Day is a very important day because it's a workers' holiday. Now, when it first began, which was in 1886, it was May 1st, and it was commemoration of the Haymarket Massacre, the strike and massacre that took place in 1886. But it was very much oriented toward struggle. The American Federation of Labor was a little bit more orientated toward barbecue. And so they invented a new Labor Day for the first weekend in September. And the first Labor Day in the city of Gary was in 1919. And that's an important date because in 1919, two national events were taking place. One is a horrible wave of race riots, because after World War I, all these soldiers came back, and there wasn't enough jobs, and there weren't enough housing for people. And so a lot of times the riots broke out because of this competition for jobs and housing. But the Labor Day in 1919 in Gary was a celebration of interracial unity. It was unique in the whole country. And I'll talk more about that when I come back next time and we talk about the 1919 strike. But one of the things I could say is 1919, there were two black leaders of the steel strike in Gary. And they both spoke, and they both spoke to the importance of racial unity, solidarity, if they were going to win rights for all. It was very inspiring. Now, if you want to celebrate it this year, there's a parade, not quite the kind of struggle that began it, but in Lowell, the 100th annual Labor Day Parade, 1919 to 2019. It will be on September 2nd, 2019. You can look it up to find out where to go. But right before the 1919 strike began, there were a group of workers at this steel rail company, Standard Steel Car, that kind of jumped the gun and went out on strike before the strike was supposed to begin. And it ended up in some violent clashes with the police. There were, in fact, 4 men who died and 60 who were injured. The state sent in state militia. It was kind of horrible. But in Hammond this year, the Hammond Historical Society is holding a very special event on Saturday, September 7th at 11 a.m. To commemorate the strike, the families that lost loved ones, the injured, and the entire community around the old Standard Steel Company. So I'm going to be there, and if you have the time, you might find it very interesting. You go, the clash that took place was at Columbia and Highland. The actual commemoration is at the Ophelia Steen Family and Health Services Center at Columbia and Highland, right in the same place. Starts at 11 o'clock. So moving right on, there's another historical celebration coming up, and that's Mexican Independence Day. This was a very important event because Mexico won its independence. And one of the first things they did was open their border to fugitive slaves. This is not very well known. So one of the major trunks of the Underground Railroad actually went in to Mexico. So this year we have two Mexican Independence Day parades. The one on September 15th in East Chicago and one in Hammond on September 21st. And Northwest Indiana Resist is preparing a very special float for this year. We are building, actually this Saturday and the Saturday after, we are building a fabulous float. It will be wrapped in a big banner that says, Stop Gary Deportations. And if you hate what's happening to immigrant children, you don't want to see people in cages, you don't want indefinite detention of young children, you should join us. Our float will have puppets representing the father of Mexican Independence Day, Jose Morelos, but it will also have Frederick Douglass, and it will have Harriet Tubman, because we are celebrating the solidarity among oppressed peoples. And we'll have flowers, we'll throw candy, but this will be a very important protest against the current administration's immigration policies. So we invite you for some fun, but also some very important education. And there will be more information in the news. I will post more. I'm not quite sure where we convene. Mm-hmm. I do believe, September 15th, staging and location to be announced.
Yeah.
So that's coming. And then the following Saturday, Hammond has its third Mexican Independence Day parade, and we will be there too. So if you're creative and you know artwork, contact me, and I'll bring you to our float building event. If not, join us at the parade because it'll be a lot of fun.
There's always the need for somebody to help put together whatever it happens to be. If it's not actually building the float, it's probably building things that would go on the float.
Well, we already built the outside of the trailer. Mm-hmm. But now we have to get – we're going to probably put a couple puppets on the trailer, and then we will carry some puppets. We also have – who do we have? We have Mother Jones. We have Frida Kahlo, the Mexican artist. Mm-hmm. So we're celebrating unity and solidarity, but with a fun as well as educational approach.
Another little history note, since we're on history talking about that today, this particular day, 64 years ago. So it's not an auspicious anniversary because it's not one of the
not
even
100.
Years. Not one of the even years, but it's still pretty important then, too. It was the date that 64 years ago, the big explosion and fire happened at the then Standard Oil Company refinery in Whiting.
Wow. That's big.
There's a lot that I know that the Indiana history website mentions, of course, what happened. And folks around here, of course, a lot of people are young enough to remember maybe as a child what the explosion was like. May have actually luckily lived in a neighborhood that in Whiting that wasn't destroyed by the fire.
That's right. And by the way, I am almost done with a four-part series mm-hmm. on the 1919 steel strike. 350,000 workers went out in the biggest national strike to that date in history, and what they wanted was union recognition and an 8-hour day. You know, they were working 12 hours, 6 days a week, and every other Sunday, a 24-hour shift. Really unbelievable. So I also want to announce a climate leadership summit that's coming up. Now, it's going to be at Goshen College in Goshen, Indiana. Mm-hmm. But if you want to be part of this, it's September 12th. It's a Thursday. And the address at Goshen College is 1900 South Main Street. You can register by going to www.earthcharterindiana.org. Then, tonight, City Council meeting mm-hmm. at 6 o'clock in the Art House will be voting on the final casino plan and approving it for the big Hard Rock Casino. Now, some of us have been fighting very hard for what we call local hiring. Mm-hmm. That doesn't just mean a couple of small businesses. It means that workers in Gary actually get a chance for a job and income, because if it's not Gary workers, the income leaves Gary every day when the workers go home. So this will be at the Art House. You might want to join in and see what's happening. And then something else, if I still have a minute. Mm-hmm. There will be a protest at Walgreens on the 6th of September. And reason why? Because the workers at Walgreens have no permanent schedules. They have no seniority rights. They are part-time and not full-time. And they have not one single sick day. So you certainly don't want to go to the Walgreens counter and encounter a sick pharmacist. So they are meeting at 2401 Ridge Road in Highland on the 6th of September at 6 p.m. to demand fair scheduling and rights for the workers at Walgreens.
And we're going to have to leave it there, Ruth. Thank you very much. We appreciate your visit and whatever you bring us up to date on the calendar of activities and activist activities, maybe we should say.
Absolutely.
It's Northwest Indiana political activist Ruth Needleman, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking. The CDC estimates that there are more than a million Americans who are living with Alzheimer's. Greg O'Brien is one of them. He's a journalist and is the co-host of a podcast about living with the disease. It's called The Forgetting, and it happens to be aired and put out by an NPR member station in Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Side Effects Public Media's Isaiah Seibert talked with O'Brien about the stigma of dementia.
Greg O'Brien, thanks for joining me.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
And so you've been very open to sharing your experience with Alzheimer's. You have a memoir, podcast, and a series on NPR. Why is it so important for you to share your story?
Well, Isaiah, it's personal for me. I lost my maternal grandfather, my mother, my paternal uncle to Alzheimer's. And before my father died, he was diagnosed with dementia. Years ago, I started the symptoms and was diagnosed after a series of brain scans and SPECT scans and clinical tests and two serious head traumas that doctors said I shouldn't have survived, that they said exacerbated the diagnosis. And I also carry the Alzheimer's gene APOE4, and there's 50% chance that my children could have the disease and my grandchildren. My journey is not about me. No one really should care about me. I'm a journalist, okay? So just like you, you know, we're telling the story, reporting the story. It's trying to get people to focus on the disease, the inaccuracy of the stereotype of the disease, and building a critical mass to try to get people out and realize that we really have to stop this. And also at the same time, this disease can take 20 to 25 years to run its serpentine course. And experts will tell you that the pathology without symptoms can start when you're in your 40s. So this isn't your grandfather's disease. And my journey has been trying to get people to talk in faith, hope, and humor about Alzheimer's while the doctors and the researchers race for a cure. We wouldn't talk about cancer. We wouldn't talk about AIDS. We need to bring Alzheimer's out of the closet. And when you look at the people who haven't been diagnosed, who have the disease, who know they have disease and are afraid to talk about it.
And what do you hope people will take away when they listen to you?
I hope they look in the mirror. I don't want their pity. I don't want them to look at me. I hope they come to understand the disease. I hope they learn more about the disease. I hope they look to their families. I hope they look to relatives of the past. And I hope they learn more about it and be more open to it. Alzheimer's, as I said before, is not the end stage. It's not you're 80 years old and you're in a nursing home. It starts when you're in your 50s or your 60s. And most of the people in this stage are afraid to talk about it. They're afraid of losing their jobs. I know a lot of people who weren't able to do their jobs. It attacks sometimes the left brain more than the right brain. And so as a writer with right brain, it's been easier for me because I have strategies of a reporter, but it's horrible, and we need to just build a critical mass.
What responses do you get from people when they hear you?
It's interesting. There was a time that, I'll give you an anecdote. I gave a speech to the Alzheimer's Association in Maine a while back, about 500 people there. And what happens in this disease, I've always told people, your brain is like an iPhone in the early stages, and I'm in the early to mid stage. It's still a sophisticated device, but it has a short-term battery, it pocket dials, and it gets lost very easily, and it drifts out. And before I gave my speech, I was with my son, because I don't travel alone anymore. I can't drive. I can't drive a boat, anything like that. And I had a blackout. And the woman who was in charge of the speech came up to me, and she said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "No, but I'm going to give the best speech of my life, because I don't speak off the cuff. I write out everything I'm going to say." And when I got out to the audience, I said, "Look, here's what happens. Here's what just happened a few minutes ago. This is Alzheimer's in real time. I'm going to miss some spots. I'm going to forget where I am. Work with me." I missed spot, and they stayed with me. When I was done, they gave a standing ovation. I said, "Well, that's nice. Thank you very much." I didn't want it to be out of pity. And I was exhausted because the battery was dead. And I went into the lobby of this hotel in Maine just to decompress. And I looked up, Isaiah, and there were 100 people standing in line. They didn't want to talk to me about me because I didn't want to talk about me. They wanted to talk about them and their families. And I said, "Okay, they're getting it." And that's the reason for this journey.
You were diagnosed 10 years ago, is that correct?
About nine years ago. And if it's a 20-year disease, I could have another 10 years. I was diagnosed probably 10 years earlier before someone would have had a diagnosis, because I was the family caregiver for my mother and father who stumbled on this disease. And I had two serious head traumas, and I felt the symptoms coming on. And as an investigative print reporter, I couldn't multitask. I couldn't do my job. I needed help. So I reached out to one of my best friends who's my personal physician, and he connected me with the experts in the Boston area who did the tests and the diagnosis. And early diagnosis is so important. Don't be afraid. Maybe that's one of the important things to say here. Anyone who is having a problem, please don't be afraid to have a clinical test. There's a difference between not knowing where your car is parked and not knowing you have a car, forgetting where your car keys are and not knowing where you have a car. And if you get to that stage, there was a time a couple years ago I took when I could drive. I don't drive anymore, so no one should be nervous. My yellow Jeep to the dump in Brewster, and we're unsophisticated on Cape Cod, so we actually take our garbage to the... It's kind of cool, because I think they should have sports pubs there, and they do a lot of politicking there, and it's kind of a good... But anyway, I'm off track. You got to keep me on track. So I dropped my trash, and then I said, "Okay, how do I get home? I could call my wife. I could call my kids. A friend will drive me." My mind in the moment would not tell me that my four-door yellow Jeep that was sitting right in front of me was my car. And that's Alzheimer's in real time. So anyone who's experienced something like that, don't be afraid. That's the most important thing we're talking about today. Reach out. Reach out to professional people who know how to do this. You need to go to the best possible professional people who do these clinical tests. And if it comes out that you need help, it's okay, because you're going to be better off that way than the other way. It's a long journey. There are medications, there are strategies and pills. As the great Bugs Bunny once said, don't take life too seriously, because nobody gets out alive. So just help yourself.
You mentioned that there's a lot of misunderstanding surrounding Alzheimer's. Do you think that prevents people from seeking care?
Yeah, it's a taboo. It's the brain. I mean, Isaiah, it's called dementia. That's the umbrella word for cognitive impairment, of which Alzheimer's is the chief disease. Listen to the word. It sounds like a demon howling in the desert. And so nobody wants to go there. I don't know if you know this, I have cancer too, and I'm not treating it. And it's my exit strategy because I've been to the nursing home with my mom and dad, and I'm not going to take my family there. I deal with intense depression, and we face bankruptcy. And it's not a sob story. It's just, I'm just an envelope for other people. But it's just understanding that there's help out there. And the greatest thing in Alzheimer's is the isolation. My mother used to talk about that. And I was there at her deathbed. I held her hand before she died. And I said, you know, we're going to start to talk about this.
So many people have secondary familiarity with Alzheimer's. They may know of a family member or friend who's living with the disease. But how do you describe it to people who have never experienced it?
Here's one way of describing it. When I would give a speech, I will ask people, how many people have ever lived in a home with a basement? Please raise your hand. People who are listening can think about that. How many people have ever done their laundry down in the basement? Please raise your hand. How many people have ever done their laundry down the basement when someone up in the kitchen didn't realize they were down there and shut the light off? It's penetrating darkness. And that's what early onset Alzheimer's is like. The light is on, the light is off. The light is on, the light is off. But you know one day someone is not going to be up in the kitchen to turn the light back on. The stereotype of it is you're 85 years old and you're drooling and you're incontinent. And by the way, I'm incontinent today, and there are times that I do drool. But it's you're in the nursing home and you can't speak. That's the final stage. This is a 20 to 25 year journey generally. There are cases where it moves quicker, but I will tell you this, that so many people from time to time say to me, well, my mother was diagnosed and she died 7 years later. To which I say, well, I mean, that's really so sad. But then I will say, in all likelihood, and I said there are always exceptions to every rule, is that your mother carried this disease for 20 or 25 years and was afraid to talk about it. And if we could get society to start to talk about this and empower people so they feel that you're not dead with this disease, you're just living with a demon that you have to fight every day, and you could still do good things. And I think that's a legacy, and I want that for my children. As I said, my journey is not for me. The train has left. I ain't coming back. But it's for my children, your grandchildren, and the children and grandchildren of people who are listening.
So you just talked about empowerment. In the podcast, you repeat three words a lot of the time: faith, hope, and humor. What do those things mean to you? Is it a source of empowerment for you?
Yeah. Well, the humor is pretty simple. I'm Irish Catholic. The most imperfect sinner in the world, by the way, and I've committed every sin a man can commit, but murder and adultery, but I have a strong faith in God. But I'm not proselytizing. Everyone finds their own level of faith, but it's a matter of faith and a higher power, I believe. And the hope is the hope for a cure. And the humor is what gets you through it, to be able to laugh. And in Alzheimer's, you become, in some ways, you lose your filter. There's some part of your brain that doesn't connect. And I joke about it that we become more Larry David-like, which childish-like. And I'm kind of enjoying it, where you say things that everyone else wants to say, but they're afraid to say. And all of a sudden you say something, they go, oh my God, I can't believe you said that.
You're no stranger to the disease yourself. You mentioned that some of your family members have had it. You've had it for going on 9 years now. But has there been anything in your journey of living with it that surprised you, that you weren't expecting at all?
People think of Alzheimer's as loss of memory. It's generally loss of short-term memory. But that's not what the disease is. The disease is a total breakdown of the body. The mind is the control panel for the body. So right now, today, and I could sit here because I'm prepped to do this, but after this interview, like I said, my brain's like an iPhone. My battery will be dead. It runs for a short period. But what people don't understand is that in Alzheimer's, it attacks at all different levels. It attacks in rage. 60% of my short-term memory can be gone in 30 seconds. If I go into a room anywhere where I see people that I don't expect to see 70% of the time. I won't know who they are. Now, I live in a place like Cape Cod. I hate cliches like it takes a village, but people there know me and they go, hey, and they kind of reintroduce themselves to me. You deal with, you know, intense depression. You deal with scary hallucinations. There's a numbness. I have no feeling now from my feet to my knees. It's neuropathy, but it's also brain signals not going down because the body shuts down because the brain is a control panel for the body. And it's like a death of a thousand cuts, and the depression is horrible, and it drives you into bankruptcy. But before people slit their throats, I want to say there's faith, hope, and humor in this. And I've always said, and I said in my book on Pluto, Inside the Mind of Alzheimer's, that lying down in wrestling, as in football, is a position of defeat. Don't lie down. If you can't get up, have someone help you get up. Reach out. Don't be afraid to talk about it. That's the most important thing. You do feel alone. I feel intense loneliness. That's why I call it Pluto. I think Pluto is the perfect metaphor for Alzheimer's. Look at the NASA pictures, intense isolation, if you could just, in people's mind. That's what Alzheimer's feels like. But realize that there is a light out there and reach for it. And that light is faith, hope, and humor in the company of others. And you can't fight this disease alone.
We got to the end of my questions. Is there anything else you want to add that we didn't touch on?
No, I just hope people reach out and talk, and that's the most important thing. We need to talk about this, and God bless anyone who's listening.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Greg O'Brien, for chatting.
Thank you.
Take care. Isaiah Seibert with Side Effects Public Media, speaking with a journalist who is living with Alzheimer's, Greg O'Brien. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.